This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's check in with the director of the UW Virology Lab, Dr. Keith Jerome. And I have to ask you, now that Omicron is peaking and we hope will suddenly flame out, have you seen any other variants showing up in the lab?
Well, first of all, Dave, at least here in the population that we're taking care of at UW Medicine, I think it's early to say we're peaking yet. As you know, we're not getting as many cases still as some parts of the country. Our positivity rates are as high as they've ever been, and most of those are Omicron. So let's hope that peak comes soon, but we're not there yet. In terms of other things, we're seeing about 90% Omicron. The other 10% are still Delta. So Delta's hanging on. We've seen that with other times that a new variant has replaced an old one, that there's this period of really rapid replacement. And then the old one sort of hangs on for a while. So we don't know how long that's going to be, but there's still definitely some Delta out there, probably somewhere just under 10% or so.
And how should we understand Omicron? We've heard everything from put your mask back on and isolate from everyone to it's mild in those vaccinated and we don't really need to worry too much about the death rate with Omicron. Where's the truth?
Well, there's a little bit of truth in all of that until you get to the point of don't worry about it. Omicron does seem to be a more benign illness. One thing that's complicated that is that most people who are getting Omicron now, most of the population's been vaccinated or has had COVID. So by definition, cases are going to be more benign. Now, COVID in a completely naive population from Omicron is probably still a bit milder, but remember that that's being exaggerated because most of us have some pre-existing immunity now. It's very reasonable to continue to take the same precautions. We all should be doing that, right? Let's try not to get this. One thing people forget is that even though it's a more benign illness, at UW Medicine, we've got more patients in the hospital than ever before through any part of this. So the hospitals are actually bursting at the seams. So that means if you have your run-of-the-mill broken arm, heart attack, stroke, all the other things that happen, there's a big line to get care. And it's stressing the system. I mean, our frontline providers are doing an amazing job trying to keep ahead of all of this, and they're working so hard. But if we can go back to that idea, sort of a flattening the curve, remember that from really early on? Mm-hmm. If we can do that and just sort of slow this down to keep some room in the hospital for all the other things that happen in human life, that would be fantastic.
But I might argue that we are still taking those same precautions we have over the last 2 years, and yet Omicron still spreads. We're as knowledgeable as ever. We're as vaccinated as ever. We're good at wearing our masks around here. How did Omicron get so out of control then? And where do you draw the line between these precautions and living with the virus?
Omicron's really good at infecting people. The viral loads are really high. It's extremely infectious, and it lives in the upper airways really well. So these are all things that make it more infectious. And we're fortunate that it doesn't infect the lungs quite as well. And that's part of the reason why it seems to be less severe when it causes disease. Look, none of these things are perfect. I mean, we've been saying that. Science has been real consistent about this. And there's a tendency to try to make everything black and white. Like, oh, you said a mask would keep me perfectly. No, I never said a mask was good. We said early on, the mask is more to protect other people. Now we have more of these N95s and KN95s and so forth. But it's not perfect. We know that, right? The vaccines aren't perfect. They struggle to keep you from getting infected, for example. They're really quite good at keeping you out of the hospital, but they're not perfect. So all these things are things we can do to slow the rate of infection down. Look, we can all go out and have an Omicron party tomorrow. And instead of, a million cases, we can have 10 million all at once. And then you literally no one will be able to get into the hospital. So that's the extreme view of this. Yeah, it stinks what we have to do. I get that. On the other hand, I think a lot of life has been much, for many of us, has been some semblance of gone back to the pre-pandemic days. I mean, okay, we wear a mask, but we're not all sitting in our homes all the time now. And it's common sense ways to minimize risk while still having a meaningful and rich life. And that's what we all need to be able to tell the difference to.
And I see what you're saying there. Yes, we are able to move about businesses and move about restaurants with certain precautions. And yes, I do feel safer getting together with my family and not isolating at home. But I may argue that for parents, for school children, for childcare workers, life is still as bad as it was at the beginning of the pandemic, if not worse because of how fast Omicron is spreading. So what can we do for that population? How can we help lift those individuals out of crisis when it's 2 years into the pandemic?
Well, this is where we need to pull together as a community, I think. We need to protect our children, first of all. And I mean, I'm not actually speaking as a virologist here. I actually don't mean protect them from the virus. I mean protect them from the effects of this pandemic, which go far past the infection itself, right? The loss of education, the loss of all the things that school provides to vulnerable children, right? I mean, food security, safety, just socialization and education, you know, first and foremost, all these things are incredibly important. And there's not an easy answer. You're talking to a virologist here, and these become political and social questions. And I think there's a generalization that we can find ways to have all of those. So, yeah, from a virology viewpoint, sure, teachers need to be vaccinated. The virologists need to get the studies done to see about even younger kids. Can they get the vaccines? The ones below 5, for example.
When is that
those
coming?
Those studies are underway. Those studies were actually modified a little bit to add in a third dose. Some of the younger people hadn't gotten a very good antibody response with 2 doses only. And we just learned that third one, called a booster, whatever, is so important in protecting, especially from Omicron. So that got added in. You got to be really careful about safety, right? We got to make sure it's safe. So probably first half of this year, Omicron will have probably come and gone, I think, and maybe we'll be past all this, or maybe we'll be on the next thing. I have no way of knowing. There's a variety of things that we can do to learn to live with this virus. It's not going away. And anybody who tells you that we're going to live in a truly post-COVID world is probably not leveling with you. These viruses are now endemic, and we're going to live with them in some manner for a very, very long time.
If COVID isn't going anywhere, what could the next variant look like? And we'll have more with Dr. Keith Jerome, head of the UW Virology Lab, later on Seattle's Morning News.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, which is his quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And this week, how an old Auburn railroad family made the most of their home's location near the Northern Pacific Tracks. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. This story is my attempt to be more like Charles Kuralt, I think.
Mm-hmm. Give it a try.
I heard from a guy named Dennis Brook with a story about his great-grandfather, who was a railroad engineer for the Northern Pacific for much of the first half of the 20th century. The railroad engineer's name was Frank Cavanaugh. He lived in Auburn with his wife in a house not too far from the Northern Pacific Tracks. You know, Auburn was a western terminus for the Northern Pacific, which is now part of BNSF, and there was a big rail yard and roundhouse there. From the early 20th century and onward, there's also a junction where trains went to either Seattle or Tacoma. Now, Frank drove trains for the Northern Pacific, and he often went right by his own house. So he and his wife developed a special way to communicate when he was nearing the end of his shift and headed west out of Stampede Pass. Their granddaughter, Joni, that's Dennis Brooks' mom, is in her 80s now, and she actually witnessed this special communication method several times from inside her grandma's house on R Street 70 years ago. So this is Joni Cavanaugh Brook telling the story about how her grandma and grandpa would communicate using a locomotive and a dish towel.
Grandma lived about 3 blocks from the railroad track, Northern Pacific, and he would come in from probably Lester or Yakima, and he would give her a signal, a toot-toot, and she would run looking for something white to open the window, and then she would flail the white rag out so that he would see that she'd heard it. So she'd go back, and 10 minutes later, she'd take off and go pick him up from the roundhouse, because they only had 1 car back then.
So I just love the visual of that.
Early text messaging.
Yeah, and that 1 car was a coupe, so the grandkids would all pile in the back and ride standing up behind the front seat with no seatbelts, of course. Now, the Cavanaughs probably weren't the only Auburn family doing something like this. Auburn really wouldn't be what it is without the Northern Pacific having built there. You know, and it really was a serious railroad town up until the 1960s. Now, Frank Cavanaugh, the whistleblowing railroad engineer, his career spanned the steam era with steam whistles and the changeover to diesel locomotives with air horns in the 50s. But since there's no recordings, I, of course, had to pester Joni Cavanaugh Brook to get her to demonstrate how her grandpa's signal whistle might have sounded.
Ooh, ooh, I don't know. Something like that.
She was a good sport. You could tell she was justifiably irritated by me, which so many people are, but she was definitely a good sport.
Yeah.
Now, the old roundhouse was torn down back in the 1980s, but there's still a rail yard in Auburn, and BNSF still runs trains over Stampede Pass and through Auburn. But some of the tracks where Frank Cavanaugh used to drive locomotives have been converted to trails. In particular, there's a really cool one called the Foothills Trail that goes between Puyallup and Buckley. Now, I tweeted out a map showing all the steps involved in this communication with the locomotive and the dish towel, and we'll have maps and photos at My Northwest a little bit later on this morning.
I can't resist. I've been dying to use this thing, which I keep in my little home studio here. You ready?
Yeah. Oh, I got to go pick up Grandpa.
Yeah. Get your towel. President Biden took one more swing at getting voting rights passed, and he missed, but he keeps talking about putting it to a vote, even though at this point it has no chance of actually passing. And I asked Margaret Brennan, the host of Face the Nation, what's the point of hammering away at this? And she says there actually is a point.
Well, this is an argument that the White House wants to be caught trying to have. They know, and it's been pretty clear now, that the votes are not there. Four times Senate Republicans have voted down these bills, and for months, the two Democrats, Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, have been clear that they are not on board with changing Senate rules to drop the benchmark from 60 votes down to 50 in order to push this through along party lines. So they don't have support from Democrats to get done what they are promising to get done here. So they know this is a losing battle, but as I said, it's a fight they want to have because they also believe in the merits, but this is a very key constituency for the Democratic Party that they are trying to deliver for, and that is why the president is making such a full-throated endorsement of these two bills.
But it's clear nothing's going to change, so I guess they're going to hold a debate on this, but I think the voting rights groups that forced him to make that fiery speech in Atlanta, mm-hmm. were tired of debate. They expected action. They expected to get an actual bill. And they're not going to get it now, right?
Well, this is that frustration that's been boiling here for years, this perception and the reality that things aren't getting done through regular order in Senate, in the Congress. Things are so partisan. Things are stalled, right? And this is kind of stunning when Democrats have the majority in both houses and the White House, that even then, that it's seemingly impossible to get legislation passed. Senator Manchin has argued anything that has to do with the foundations of democracy, like election law, need to be bipartisan and end of sentence because it is so foundational. Democrats, including the president, have said pretty strongly they believe the Senate rules are broken, that Congress can't function like it's supposed to, which is why the rules need to be changed. And of course, Republicans, they are saying changing rules is a sliding scale of really dangerous things to do here. But on the fundamental policy issues around election law and reform, there are some real important conversations to have. They're not being had because of the partisan overlay to this.
Well, but will the Democrats try to put everything into this bill? They put public financing into this bill, which has always been controversial. So are you saying they might be able to break it up into pieces that do get bipartisan support, like the infrastructure thing?
Well, on election reform and laws, there are some proposals out there, and the White House has actually been pretty swift to swat them down. Just last week, for example, a small group had been started up by Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, to try to get the Electoral Count Act, for example, this arcane mm-hmm. law that was at the heart of the false premise for the siege on January 6th, the perception of what the vice president's role actually is in certifying election results. Just even updating that for clarity's sake. She had been putting that forward, saying, okay, let's start here. Let's see what else we can attach. And the vice president and the Senate majority leader, Chuck Schumer, came out and said, no way, no how. There is this frustration that there are attempts to find some ability to chip away at the problem. Democrats in the White House are arguing the problem is so vast that the rules need to be changed.
Hmm. Seems to me the fundamental problem is that even though, as you pointed out, Democrats have the majority, it's a really slim majority.
Correct. Yeah.
And Joe Biden does not control his party the way Donald Trump controls his party.
Well, you know, President Biden ran and promised on this premise of governing sort of from the middle, from uniting the country, that, you know, we'd been governed by the extremes and that he didn't want to stand for that. And he was going to bring us all together. 1 year into his presidency, we're going to look at whether he has done that. We have Anthony Salvanto, the CBS News polling guru, to bring us the perception of what the president has been able to do, whether he has actually tried to govern from the middle, or as Republicans have argued, has gone to the progressives a bit too much or been too deferential to them. We will see. This is part of the fundamental perception issue going into the 2022 midterm races.
Margaret Brennan, the host of Face the Nation. Just days after the State Medical Association sent a letter calling on Governor Inslee to take action to help overwhelmed hospitals, he is calling in the National Guard. With the report, here's Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott.
The Omicron variant is spreading so fast that hospitals are officially in crisis mode. Just yesterday, some 17,000 new cases reported by the Department of Health, and the governor says hospitalizations are way up.
We do believe we are in for several weeks of very hard slogging in Washington State, where all of us have to pitch in together, because we don't know where that peak will be. It's likely to be later than many places, because this hit us later than many places in the United States. And the hospitalization rates will continue to go up even after the infection rate peaks, because hospitalizations follow the peak of the infection. We currently have over 2,000 COVID hospitalizations across the state, and COVID patients today make up about 18% of all the people in our hospitals and 22% of our ICUs. And unfortunately, those numbers are going to continue to climb. Now, we know roughly about 80% of those people, unfortunately, are not vaccinated. So there are many things we need to do to try to help our hospitals through this this crisis.
One of the biggest needs?
First, we want to help them with staffing shortages. And this is really most of the problem is not a physical logistics problem. It's a staffing shortage problem, both because of the increase in cases and because people who work in these hospitals are themselves becoming ill. So we know that the staff shortages have pushed hospitals beyond their capacity. So I am ordering 100 members of the Washington State National Guard, this is non-clinical personnel, to across the state to help hospitals to assist in non-medical tasks to alleviate issues, particularly in their emergency departments, and also to add testing capacity at these hospitals to get the testing to alleviate the challenge in emergency departments.
On top of that,
we're going to send that personnel to Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, to Yakima Valley Memorial Hospital in Yakima, to Confluence Central Washington Hospital in Wenatchee, and Providence Sacred Heart in Spokane. Now, we'd also like to help by doing some of the testing now doing hospitals, doing out outside the hospitals. So we're going to deploy guard personnel to run those testing operations. We've heard that many from the hospitals and many people with COVID symptoms are seeking testing in the emergency departments. We want to alleviate that pressure on the emergency departments.
And?
Call up these individuals for a month. We really appreciate them coming out of their civilian life to do this. They've been working really, really hard the last 2 years, and we appreciate their efforts. We're going to send that personnel to Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, to Yakima Valley Memorial Hospital in Yakima, to Confluence Central Washington Hospital in Wenatchee, and Providence Sacred Heart in Spokane. Now, we'd also like to help by doing some of the testing now doing hospitals, doing out outside the hospitals. So we're going to deploy guard personnel to run those testing operations. We've heard that many from the hospitals and many people with COVID symptoms are seeking testing in the emergency departments. We want to alleviate that pressure on the emergency departments. So those testing teams will be placed at Providence St. Peter Hospital in Olympia, Cadillac Regional Medical Center in Richland, UW Medicine Harborview in Seattle, and MultiCare Tacoma General Hospital.
So this sounds like a big deal then.
It's a very big deal because the hospitals are, you know, you can't go. Providence Everett is where I just was actually when I hurt my hand a month ago or so. And you went in the emergency room and there was
you know, a couple dozen people there. I think I was there at like 10:30 at night, and now they're at capacity. I have my regular doctor who is there too, who told me that they were stretched way beyond their capacity. So that's where one of the guard teams will be going. And all of these hospitals, you're going to struggle to get in. So on top of bringing out the National Guard to help with that testing and to also help, you know, with the staffing issues, they're calling on a pause to non-urgent procedures once again, which I don't believe we've seen since the very beginning of the pandemic. And I want to make sure that I'm clear about that. This is non-urgent or elective, as they like to call it, surgeries and procedures in hospitals. So not like the original when we did it the first time around where you couldn't go to the dentist and various other places. Mm-hmm. This is just for hospital care.
Now, I was reading the list of criteria for what is urgent and non-urgent, and it's basically, I mean, who gets to decide whether it make that decision? Is it your doctor?
It is your doctor, and so it's the hospital. The doctor will make up that decision. It depends. I mean, if you're at a big hospital, I think that somebody above, like the individual doctor, might have a say in that. But it's a judgment call based on that criteria that you see that I went through as well in the actual proclamation. And I believe some of that was changed because I remember we had during the original where they had this pause on elective procedures. There was a little girl, I believe, that was someone who had been in need of a surgery that was not considered urgent, but was making her quality of life terrible every day. So they went in and tweaked it, I think, a couple of times. This has got, they think, addressed everything that might be necessary to make sure there's enough wiggle room for, if as long as you're not going to die or be living in misery, that you can, you know, put it off.
Well, I mean, I'll bring up the example of heart surgery, where you find that there's something that could possibly cause a heart attack and should be corrected, but there's, you don't know whether there's an imminent danger. Is it going to happen tomorrow? Is it going to happen 5 years from now?
And that's the thing. It'll be like you said. It'll be the doctor, your doctor, right? Your doctor's going to know you, look at your case, and have to make that call. Is it worth the, you know, is it possible that you could die by not having this or something like that? And they're going to have to make that decision.
And how long is this going to last, this crunch?
I believe that the pause is all for, all of this is just for 30 days, if I'm not mistaken.
Because I know we had a prediction from IHME, the University of Washington, that the peak was going to be on the 25th. So
no, and see, and I heard a couple of you and some others reporting that, and from IHME, I had heard from other health experts that we were looking at almost the beginning of March for a peak.
Seriously?
So, yes, but that was before, and then so I heard I believe the governor, or maybe it was Dr. Shah, our state health secretary, say that they were expecting our peak to be somewhere a little more towards the end of February, probably.
Okay, so we're talking at least a month then.
Several weeks, and you heard that from the governor yesterday say, we expect this to last. We're going to have several weeks ahead that are going to be tough. And he said, you know, first of all, Omicron started its rise here later than most other places. It didn't happen here right away. And so we've got the lag, right? You've got the 17,000 cases reported yesterday, Dave.
Wow.
So, you know, remember back the 14-day ratio of new cases, that the rolling average or whatever, that was, I think it was Pierce County. Back in the beginning, it was like 200 and 300% that you didn't want to hit. It was 1,600+% their 14-day average, like a few days ago. So well, these numbers are just astronomical.
So we're really in triage mode, and that's going to, now presumably then that's going to apply to unvaccinated people who come down with COVID. There's not going to be a room for them either.
Right. That's the problem. And you said 80% of the 2,000 plus people who are hospitalized with COVID right now are unvaccinated people. So, again, you have that same push. That's the problem. You need to have get vaccinated, get your two shots or one shot, depending on which one you have, and then get boosted. They stressed that.
But then
big
at least
time.
It's not to the point where they're setting up tent hospitals, because remember in the very beginning?
No.
We had big tents and stuff, so they're not going to do that.
And it's not, no, and it's not, and because it's, I don't even think that it's that they don't have the beds. I think it's that they don't have the staff.
The staff, right.
It's the problem. That's why you've got the National
Guard. Staff, there's nobody to fill them, right.
And he put another call out yesterday for all of the retired healthcare workers to please, if you would, come back for a few weeks. We need you.
All right, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
That means it's time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. I was just tickled pink when earlier this week I saw on the John and Sherry show, which is afternoons here on Cairo Radio, 3 to 7. He did an act of kindness and was just John Curley. He was high on this act of kindness, discovering that it's courageous and vulnerable to be kind. And he loved it. And so he wanted to share why he did it. So I took some portions out from their show. This aired on the 11th in the afternoon. They kind of started off the show with it because John was just so excited about being kind. And so here is how it started.
Saturday, I'm feeling sort of down. I haven't been able to jump in the water because it's all frozen over. And my neighbor sends me video of her mom, who's in her late 70s, and her friends, also in their late 70s, going across an ice-covered road to deliver home-baked cookies to all of the truckers that are stuck there on I-90, waiting to get onto I-90 near the Safeway in Clee Ellum, carrying their packages of fresh-baked cookies and soup to these guys. There's about 15 or 20 trucks just sitting there. And as you know, or maybe you don't know, that these truckers don't make any money when they're not sitting. If they're not rolling, they're not putting miles on. They're just, it's just costing them money. And I went home and I saw it and I said to Lene, I'm going to do something.
He is going to do something. And here's what he did.
I called up Senior Bones and I bought 15 burritos and I went there and gave out burritos to these guys. And it's really amazing. I came home, I felt great. I just felt so great that, you know, it was a bit of an effort because you had to go back and get them and then hand them out and stuff. But it was amazing. It just gave me a high for like the rest of the evening.
And it's easy for me to sort of chuckle and be like, John, of course, kindness is going to make you feel good. But I think, you know, anybody, myself included, forgets sometimes. And we think smiling and nodding or saying, hey, how you doing, counts as being a kind person, when really a selfless act of spending money you may or may not have, delivering goods to people you do not know, complete strangers on the side of the road in trucks. It'll surprise you how, and he talked later about how he just felt like almost a chemical change in his brain that lasted for, you know, hours or a day after. So maybe try it out yourself. If John Curley can do this courageous act of kindness, which we all know John has a big heart, maybe you can this weekend too.
I think it's a great story. And now, at 7:48, direct from the Gene Ursula Show, here is G. Scott. So, who do you root for this weekend?
Well, let's see. I root for my honeydew list to be really short. I root for my coffee Saturday morning to be amazing. Mm-hmm. I root for the sun to come out on the weekend. Oh, you're talking about football. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to keep it a buck with you. That means I'm going to keep it 100. I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't care. The Seahawks are done. I don't care. I really have no interest.
No, wait, don't you have a secondary team?
No. I don't have any secondary team. Like, that's it. Oh, the Ohio State Buckeyes, they're done. Their season's over. The Seahawks, their season's over. If I watch some football, like, it might be in between doing something this weekend. Like, oh, let me just see what's happening. I don't even know, Colleen, Dave, I don't know who's playing tomorrow. I don't know what time they're playing. I don't know who's playing tomorrow as opposed to Sunday. I'd imagine the next time that I really sit down to watch a game will be probably the NFC Championship and the AFC Championship.
Oh. Tomorrow is Raiders versus Bengals.
Raiders versus Bengals.
I'd say Raiders, right? Because Marshawn Lynch kind of touched that.
Well, what I was going to do was just look up the schedule and see who Arizona is playing. And since we beat Arizona, were Arizona to win, that would mean the Seahawks actually won.
So you want the Rams to win because the Cardinals play the Rams on Monday.
Hey, Colin, you know what's crazy? You're telling me that the Raiders and the Bengals play tomorrow. Let me just tell you how not focused on football. I just talked to KJ Wright yesterday, congratulating him on making it to the playoffs. This is awesome. This is cool. And I still did not know that they played the Bengals.
It sounds like you're not a very good friend.
I'm a good friend. I'm just selfish. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's like
a homer. That's fine.
It's like what as someone who's been divorced a bunch of times. You know what I mean? Like, hey, who else going to be there? All Larry and his wife, and Harry and his wife, and George and his wife. I'm like, well, I ain't going. I'm the only single one there. I'm a hater.
Well, we do know we don't want the Cardinals to win. We don't want the Patriots to win. I don't
wait,
care about the
wait.
I don't know what.
I want the Patriots to win.
Why?
I want the yes. I want the Patriots
to win. Oh, because Tom Brady's not on the team anymore.
Tom Brady's not. I thought we hated the
Patriots no matter what.
No. Here's the thing about the Patriots. I love the fact that Tom left them. Was like, okay, I'm out of here. I can go do this myself. And Tom leaves, and he go builds him a house, and he builds him a new family, and they go to Disney World every year, and they win, right? And so now Bill Belichick is like, oh, you left me with all these kids by myself, and I'm single. And now Bill Belichick is building himself up. He's becoming independent. You know what I mean? And now they're in the playoffs, and they see, thought I never couldn't do this without you. And they're in the playoffs, and I am rooting for Bill Belichick and the Patriots to win the Super Bowl.
Oh, okay. Didn't see that coming.
So do we have anything to worry about in terms of personnel changes at the Seahawks?
No. When you say worry, you don't have to worry about the main folks. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And the main folks, that's John Schneider. Don't have to worry about him. Mm-hmm. Pete Carroll. You don't have to worry about him. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you don't technically have to worry about Russ because technically he's under contract, number one. Mm-hmm. And two, he has a no trade clause in his contract. So if Russ decides not to be the quarterback for the Seattle Seahawks, it's probably because of him, right? Like he decided like, yeah, you know what, maybe I don't want to be here. Well, maybe it was a mutual agreement. But
so what was the meeting between Carol Schneider and Jody Allen?
I think they had a meeting yesterday, you know what I'm saying, the three of them. And we don't know what happened in that meeting. I think the meeting was to get together and figure out what decisions need to be made for the future. I'm quite sure, you know, whatever changes or whatever thing they decide to, they'll let us know when they want us to know. But all I keep thinking about, Colleen, is how did that meeting go down? Like, did Pete Carroll walk in like the scene in Goodfellas when Joe Pesci walks in and Jody Allen and John Schneider were behind Pete and Pete's like, oh, is this it? Is this it? And they said, nah, we ain't going to do you this
time. What's Jody like? We don't even know. We know that John and Pete are buddies, right? Like, they're like frat bros. I don't know what Jody's like.
Hey, what's the one show? What if Jody talks to John and Pete like they used to talk to Charlie's Angels? Remember they used to sit around the desk and they had a little speaker? And what if Jody talks through the speaker to them?
That would be weird and that would be a big story.
I mean, but don't you, the suspense. Or maybe they met at Applebee's.
Could be.
You know what I mean? Or maybe, like James said, maybe they met at an abandoned mall and they walked around the mall, right? Like, mm-hmm. I would just want to be at the... What was that meeting
sounds
like?
Sounds like a kidnapping.
And the whole time, Russell was in the back seat, hogtied, and, you know, just in case the outcome of the mall meeting wasn't great.
It's like, okay, so we got him out in the car, Jody. So what you want to do?
What are the orders, boss?
Well, all right, you know it's Friday, Dave. I can't believe you let me and Colleen go off the rails like this.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. The first hint you get of that happening, you will give the news desk a call, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah. I'm gonna call you guys up. Okay. Like, very yo, good. they're leaving. Everybody's alive.
Gene Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. So, Colleen, I think we should play a little more of our conversation with Dr. Keith Tyrone.
Absolutely.
We had a heart-to-heart with him yesterday, after the show, actually. He is the head of the University of Washington Virology Laboratory, and we'll put the whole thing in its entirety on the Seattle's Morning News podcast. One of the things I wanted to know was, what's the next strain? Because back when there was Delta, he was talking to us about how this thing continued to evolve, and sure enough, Omicron crops up. And there's no law that says at some point COVID-19 is going to stop evolving. So does this become
mild like the flu tends to be, or is it fundamentally different than the flu?
From a virology point of view, I have to say it's different from the flu. It's a different virus. It's the entire structure and genomics of it are different. But in terms of its effect on us, once you get past the virology aspects, yeah, maybe it becomes more like the flu in that we have waves every year. And some years are worse than others, but it's at a level that we tolerate as a society. I mean, lots of people die of flu, and it's a tragedy for the people and families involved, and yet society goes on. And that's probably something we're going to have here, but we need to get it to a level that's more controlled. And we need to have a bigger conversation about what that is. The Omicron was encouraging in that regard, that it is a more mild illness. But are there guarantees that you couldn't have a new variant that's very infectious and severe clinically? Sure, it's a concern.
Let's talk about kids, because I hear people arguing it's really not a problem for kids. Based on the breakouts of the CDC, comparing the number of people, for example, in nursing homes who've died compared to the number of kids, there's no comparison. So how do you evaluate the true danger to children?
Kids tend to do better with infection than adults do. That's clear. There have been about 8 million cases in kids and 30,000 hospitalizations and less than 1,000 deaths. So yeah, they do better. And that's got to play into the thoughts about keeping schools open and after school activities and all those other things that kids do well. And we can lower that risk even more if the vaccines prove to be effective and safe. There's still lots of parents who I talk to are really concerned and really want to get their kids vaccinated, the younger children, the under fives, and they just can't yet for preschool and so forth. And so that's going to be something else we add in. But yes, Dave, you're exactly right. Children do better with this infection.
You can tell me I'm wrong on this, but I do sense frustration from you that you just have to say the same thing over and over and over again, and we're fighting through this pandemic as much as anyone, and you're staring the virus straight in the eye through this pandemic. Is there something you wish you could express to the public, or maybe vaccine hesitant as a virologist? You can let it off your chest right now if you want.
Well, I've told Dave before, I think most of the people who were going to convince or who are going to get a vaccine have had it. There's a slow road for just a handful at a time at this point. I personally have kind of gotten past spending a ton of time trying to, this is awful to say, but to try to convince individuals. I generally, don't engage with the most adamant folks who can make this sort of an ugly thing. All I can tell people is when the vaccines became available, I signed up immediately. I did wait until the people in my lab who were physically handling it more than I do could go first, but I was signed up. And as soon as they were vaccinated, I got mine, and I encouraged my family to do that. And, that's all I can say is I put my money, my own health on the line for this. And it was not a difficult call. It was not difficult at all. Protect yourself, protect those who love you, protect others. It's the right thing to do.
It's a community thing. I have a question for you as a virologist based on a personal experience, and maybe the data's not in yet, or perhaps you can shed some light on this because it confused me. My 8-year-old had to isolate for the first time last week since returning to school, which I think is a pretty good run, if you ask me, considering how many kids are in each classroom. Because she only had one of her two vaccine shots, though, she had to isolate while fully vaccinated students who were also exposed to this positive case they could stay in the classroom. And that surprised me, considering breakthrough cases. So is there any knowledge you can shed on if it's effective to isolate non-fully vaccinated and let fully vaccinated continue at school? I don't know how to understand this scenario.
So the isolation and quarantine recommendations have been in flux. They've been changing, as I think you know, and most recently have updated on January 9th, I think is the last update. So I always encourage people just to go to that CDC webpage, just Google, what do I do if I'm infected, been exposed, and you'll get the CDC, and it has a nice little chart that you can actually follow along. It's a difficult call. The trouble is there's no black and white, Kelly. This is the thing, right? We know that people are most infectious early in the illness, either right at the time they first get sick or even before that. And we know that later on, they're much less infectious, so much less risk for others. So that's why the quarantine times in general have shortened. We also know kids need to be in school, and so we're trying to balance those things. Sure, you could be 100% safe and keep everybody sequestered for 3 weeks, and but that would come with an enormous cost. It's the same way with the healthcare system, right? We have a terrible shortage of nurses and doctors now, right? Because lots of us are getting sick, and so we want to get people back to work as soon as we can when it's still safe. So that's where these have gotten short. And again, the one vaccine versus two, we know that two doses are more effective than one. Neither one's perfect. And so there's just been a line drawn in there, and it's unfortunate that folks get caught on one side or the other of it. But that's where this is all coming from.
I see. And by the way, she tested negative after 5 days after her exposure. So that was good news. I just, I'm all for keeping kids in classrooms. I just didn't understand that distinction between fully vaccinated and only one shot and one having to isolate and not. So thank you for that.
Now, I have to ask, are viruses that clever? Did Omicron specifically evolve itself to be mild such that people wouldn't know they had it and therefore wouldn't isolate, making it easier to spread? Is it that smart?
So that's an argument that's made a lot, this idea that viruses move to be less pathogenic over time. It's probably true. It's a simple matter of evolution. Obviously, they're not really thinking about it, but if it allows them to spread more effectively because the people are still walking around, sure, that gives the virus an advantage. What's scary about this virus, again, is that people are most infectious before they're sick, which means the virus may care a little bit less about how sick you ultimately get.
Yeah, it just wants to spread, right? So it's thinking,
exactly.
Okay, and I'll infect them, they won't know, and then I'll start spread before they can put that mask on.
So one of the ideas is that Omicron had this series of mutations that made it infect the upper airways better, so the nose and so forth, which is better for spreading, right? It's closer to the outside. Those happen to have at the same time reduced their ability to infect the lungs. But if Omicron had found a different way of becoming more infectious that maybe didn't prevent those lung infections, maybe it would have been really terrible. And that's what we worry about, right, is that it doesn't necessarily need to make these trade-offs.
Dr. Keith Jerome, the director of the UW Virology Lab, keep up the good work. Keep us safe. And thank you very much.
All right, Dave. Bye, Colleen. Take care.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.